Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When it comes to family, there's the family you're related to by blood, and there's the family you bring into your life by choice. And sometimes you find those people in unexpected places, as Julie Margaret Hogben did. Saturday Night Live cast member Cecily Strong reads Julie's essay, When the Doorman is Your Main Man.
It was summertime in Manhattan, dark and balmy, almost midnight on the Upper West Side. Drinks had gone well. Walking me home, he held my hand. Tipsy, I said, you can't come up, and stopped near a stoop. I don't want to, he said coyly, placing his hands on my waist, drawing me close. But I do want to see you again. He smiled. I smiled. What I mean is, if you want to kiss me goodnight, it has to be here. We weren't even close to my building. But I thought you lived in, he said, craning his neck to look for street signs, the 90s. I do, but see, he knows we're on our first date, and there's a window he can see out of under the sidewalk, and sometimes he's waiting. If I'm late, he can get worried. Who? My date asked, looking concerned. Who can see us? I hedged. Your boyfriend? No. Your dad? No, it's hard to... Your husband? Are you married? I sighed and shrugged, flying my freak flag, ruining the moment. My doorman. Gazim was my doorman, and ours was a common and unsung friendship. That between women living in New York, single and alone, and the doormen who take care of them, acting as gatekeepers, bodyguards, confidants, and father figures. The doormen who protect and deliver much more than Zappos boxes and Fresh Direct. Not because it's part of the job, but because they're good men. I don't like him, Gazim said of a new guy it was dating 2 months later. He whispered this over the intercom. I entered the lobby and saw them outside, my doorman and my date on the sidewalk, laughing and chatting. My date turned to flick his cigarette away, and Gazim took the moment to shoot me a look. He'd gotten the scoop and was already wary. I waved goodbye as my date and I walked off. When I glanced back, Gazim shook his head. I rolled my eyes. What did he know? What could he tell from a 10-minute talk? My date turned out to be sexy and funny, spoke gorgeous Hebrew, and partied too much. And so I agreed to a second drink and saw him again. And again, as autumn drew on, I was always attracted to bad boys. Gazim wasn't a bad boy. He was kind and well-mannered. A gray-haired cross between Cary Grant and George Clooney. Born in Albania in the mid-1940s, he hailed from an educated military family. His father had been an army general. When Gazim was 19, the communist leader Enver Hoxha's secret police arrested and interned his family, accusing them of treason. For 20 years, he lived in a labor camp, forced to farm in a remote area, not unlike Stalin's gulags. My whole life as a young man, he said to me once. He never married, never had children. At 39, he was finally released, and the United States granted his family asylum. He found a job as a white-glove doorman in New York. Whenever I asked him how he was, on any day, at any hour, he always said, no complaints. That was his mantra. On Halloween night that same year, I walked home again, this time alone, from CVS. I couldn't sleep. In pajama bottoms and a t-shirt, I skipped up the steps into the lobby, a white paper bag clenched in my hand. Hidden inside was a pregnancy test. Kazim was resting on his usual stool, half on, half off, and looked up from his New York Post. "What?" he said. "What?" I said. "Nothing." "What is it?" "Nothing." I sailed past and held up the bag. "Headache, Tylenol." "No," he said in a drawn-out way, shaking his head, folding his newspaper closed. I couldn't fool him. I stopped and looked around. No one was in the lobby. Fine. It was well after midnight, so I doubled back. I bit my lip. I missed a, my face contorted and I started to cry. Kazim waited, then said, "The Israeli?" "Yes, and I don't even like him," I said, wiping my tears. "He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him."
"So don't," Kazim said, straightening the cuffs of his uniform jacket.
We stood and talked for 2 more hours. I was distraught. I thought I'd been safe, counted the days and done the math, used protection most of the time. "How did this happen?" I stupidly asked.
"How?" Kazim said with a wry smile. "Come on, it's life."
2 weeks later, I told the father. He seemed at once delighted and horrified. A few weeks later, he even proposed. I politely declined. He didn't want to be a parent, not really. We didn't want to marry each other. We both knew the truth. I said I'd raise the baby myself, and he could be involved as little or as much as he wanted to be. He was off the hook as long as we kept the drama at bay and stayed in touch. We three would be friends, if not family. He agreed. 3 months later, and starting to show, I broke the news to everyone else. My Catholic parents, married over 40 years, feared for my future as a single mother. I didn't blame them. My girlfriends, married and single, mothers or childless, were mostly supportive. But I became fodder for gossip. Who was the father? Did I dump him or did he dump me? Valid questions. Sometimes asked in my face, sometimes not. But down in the lobby, Kazim was there with no dog in the race. I wasn't his daughter, sister, or ex. I wasn't his employee or boss. Our social circles didn't overlap. 6 days a week, he stood downstairs, detached, but also caring enough to be the perfect friend, neither worried nor pitying. It was he who signed for the crib when it came, for the onesies, bottles, and boxes of diapers. It was he who asked how I felt every day. I saw the Israeli every few weeks. Kazim and I talked a lot over those 9 months, and his worldly perspective comforted me. More European than tri-state, more Cold War than 21st century, and grounded in gratitude. His stance was resolute. He upheld and honored me for my choice and protected my dignity and self-esteem. I was still young, he reminded me. I could still meet a man and get married. I had a master's degree, a job, savings. So what if I wasn't married? Look at the world. Worst things had happened in history. Please, we would be fine. My baby was a gift. In August, while I was away for the weekend, my water broke early and I gave birth in Providence, Rhode Island. 2 days later, my parents picked me up and drove me south on Route 95 to the Upper West Side and home. When my father pulled up, Kazim knew the car. He skipped down the steps and swung the back door wide open. Somehow, he knew what was waiting inside. I climbed out, exhausted and teary. We hugged. We both gazed at the sleeping newborn, impossibly pretty. "Beautiful," he said. "Wonderful job." 9 days later, the Israeli left for good. His father was sick back home, he said. But we were friends and on good terms, and for the next year, I emailed him photos. He called and we laughed as he kept me awake during those first long, sleepless months. But Kazim's was the face we saw every day, the man who said good morning and good night to my girl, who smiled and cooed and remarked on her growth, her smile, and her first words. The Israeli kept in touch for over a year and then disappeared. No more emails or calls. I'd send photos. and he'd send silence. My daughter held a special affection for Kazim, almost as if she understood the role he had played as someone who welcomed her into the world with open arms and open heart, ready and willing to guard and protect her, just as he had guarded and protected her mother. She'd run down the sidewalk, arms outstretched, and he'd catch her up into a big hug. Her father doesn't call or visit, and we don't call or visit him. But we visit Kazim. We live in California now, but when we're in New York, we drop by the building, hoping to find Kazim at his post. Sometimes he is. Sometimes he isn't, but we always check. And when we find him, and he asks how I'm doing, I look at my girl, and I say, no complaints.
Cecily Strong, reading Julie Margaret Hogben's essay, When the Doorman is Your Main Man. We'll hear how Julie and her daughter Isabel are doing after the break.
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now a postscript from the author of this week's essay, Julie Margaret Hogben.
My daughter is 8 years old now. 3 years ago, we moved out of New York City and we live in California now. She's doing great. I think her biggest complaint is that she would still like a dad. So I am still single, if anybody out there knows anybody. But, you know, we have a great life. We're very lucky. We have supportive friends and family and so that's sort of where we are. I'm not in touch with her dad. He doesn't reach out. He doesn't send any money. You know, it's too bad, and especially for her. I think I have sort of the life experience to know that only a specific kind of person and a particular kind of man could step out of his own child's life completely. So in a way, that points to the possibility that she and I are both really dodging a bullet. I think in anyone's life, when you step off sort of a conventional path, you really find out quickly who your friends are. People show their true colors. And Kazim was among a couple of people who just embraced me and my situation with open arms, no judgment, and just this very worldly perspective that said, what other people think doesn't matter. This is your family. It just, nothing else matters.
At this point in our conversation with Julie, we told her that we had a surprise guest on the line from New York City.
I am Kazim Bekteshi. I work as a doorman.
Yay. Hi, Kazim.
Hi, Julie.
How are you?
How are you?
I'm good, honey. I'm good. We miss you guys. We miss everybody.
How is Izzy doing?
She's good.
Julie did a very big step. She decided to have the baby and to not have the relationship with the baby's father, which at that time, for me, is a very, very strong on my eyes.
Thank you, Kazim.
No, thank you. That's true. I've been judged as a person when my father was condemned. So all my life, I've been judged without knowing me who I am. How can I judge Julie's life without having no any reason? We have only to help as a human being and support. And was her decision at the very end. Nobody could decide for her.
I think the part of the reason why Kazim and I have this sort of Juju is because we are already empathetic people and we are already people who are not put off by the unconventional. I think you just sort of viscerally feel that, smell that, know that in another person.
The doorman is a person, has a name. That work is a low-level work. It's not qualified work. But doormen in New York are good human beings. I am going to protect all the the New York doormen.
You really have to take time to listen to and see and know the people around you on a daily basis, or else you're losing out. The single mother thing, to raise a child, educate a child, run a household, work full time, it's very difficult. It's very straining. And so I try to be the Gazim for other people in my life. I keep an eye out for people who need that person to sort of step into their purview and say, I recognize things are not perfect right now. You are loved and supported, and you know, you have a friend here if you need one.
The point for Julie is, Julie, be strong.
Yeah, no, I am.
So is life.
You're right.
Ciao, Julia.
Ciao.
Julie Margaret Hogben, author of When the Doorman Is Your Main Man. She also wrote the novel Allie Hughes Has Sex Sometimes under the pen name Jules Moulin, which comes out in paperback on June 14th. We also heard from Guzim Bekteshi, who works as a doorman in Manhattan. And now a word from the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, Daniel Jones.
In Julie's essay, Guzim provides such a refreshing perspective and sort of this grounded reality that gives her the confidence to go forward. It also is instructive in how the different ways we form families and who is important to us. Julie goes forward with this birth, you know, without the support of a typical husband or father figure for the child, but sort of brings in this man, Guzim, who's so important in her life and makes himself important, and she sort of accepts that. It really speaks to having an open mind about how families are formed and how love is shared. Julie's story is an example of life is what happens while we're making other plans. It's an example of saying yes to things. How many times do we hear, I'm waiting to have children until the time is right? Whether it's having a baby or buying a first home, or, you know, it's very hard to get all your ducks in a row before making any of these huge life decisions. And I like how Julie just says yes to it.
Modern Love editor Dan Jones. Special thanks to Cecily Strong for reading this week's essay. You can see her on Saturday Night Live. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.